Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones. Afternoon, Charlotte.
Good afternoon, Stu. Nice to be here. So where do we start?
Well, we have to start really with last week's tragic events and the sinking of Bajan, the 56-metre Perini, which went down off the coast of Sicily, claiming tragically seven lives. Ricaldo, Rick Thomas, the yacht chef, Hannah Lynch, Mike Lynch, Jonathan Bloomer, Judy Bloomer, Chris Morvillo and Nada Morvillo very sadly lost their lives. And our thoughts and deepest condolences obviously go out to all those who lost loved ones in this tragic incident, and also to the survivors who must be dealing with some really serious trauma following that horrendous evening or very early morning on the 19th of August.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that it's just so tragic, and I don't know anyone that's not been really taken by this, either in the superyacht industry or not.
Yeah, it was, it was the biggest news story in the world last week, wasn't it, really? 15 survivors of the 22 on board, of which 9 were crew. And I think at this point, it's important to say that we still don't know precisely what happened that night. So first we heard that the yacht sank in minutes, then it was 16 minutes, it was a water spout, then it was a downburst, whatever a downburst is. Hopefully you'll be able to tell me a bit more about that in a minute, Charlotte. People were reporting that the mast broke initially, then it didn't break. Some people said a hatch was open, some people said a hatch wasn't open. Was the keel up or down? You know, the weather forecast that night, some people said it was benign, others saying there was a storm warning. You know, loads of reporting and noise and speculation, but not a huge amount of clarity yet. And it's that absence of facts that can be dangerous with a story like this, given the pace of the news cycle. So the hunger and demand for further detail can lead to some pretty wild speculation. And, you know, when the newspapers and news channels are just desperate for comment from anyone, really, it can encourage some voices to make some pretty wild claims and come up with some pretty wild theories about what happened and assign blame when it's probably too early to do that. When we don't know the full facts of the evening, it's very harsh to start blaming people. But we will, of course, obviously, eventually get a very full accounting of what happened that night. So Bajan was a UK flagged vessel. So as well as an Italian investigation, responsibility for determining what happened that night falls onto the Marine Accident Investigation Branch. So in my former life at various other yachting titles, I had to report a lot on MAIB investigations. And in my experience, they're a really competent and thorough organization. Often they release a preliminary report followed by a much fuller one later on, laying out all the facts in great detail. But when that will happen, I don't know at the moment.
Well, I think, like you said, the facts are so important here, and the pace that, you know, at one point I was checking, you know, all different news outlets, everyone saying something different, lots of it kind of quite wildly inaccurate. I think it is kind of inevitable what happens when you're discussing quite technical things to do with the build of the yacht and things, and you've got reporters and other people kind of chiming in who just aren't experienced in this field, you inevitably get some really major kind of errors and things. But I wondered, you know, you were asked to comment quite a lot. Lots of us here at BI were contacted by various outlets. And how do you actually feel about being part of that?
Well, my first instinct is to learn as much as I can, because I didn't, you know, I obviously, you know, we all know quite a lot about the sector, but I didn't know the precise and finer details of Bajan's naval architecture. So I reached out to, you know, owners and captains of similar boats and said, you know, what is the keel structure on Bajan? Tell me more. You know, because terms like lifting keel don't entirely tell the whole story. Obviously, Bajan has a significant, you know, keel box that carries a lot of ballast. Within that is a deployable centerboard. And trying to explain the finer points of things like that to journalists can be quite tricky. And so, you know, lots of the graphics even that they were using on the big news websites were just, you know, profoundly wrong. So we do have a responsibility to stick our oar in and try and get the coverage as accurate as it possibly can be. But I'm open to commenting. Of course I am, because I think we have to have a stake. I think we've got to, make the point, because, you know, they're not native to this industry. They don't know. We've got to make the point that this was a freak, complete freak, this accident. And it's not a common occurrence at all in the super yacht business, especially for an accident to claim so many lives. I mean, I can't think of another one. So it's extremely rare, almost unheard of. You know, there's a vanishing chance of it ever happening again, hopefully, once all the learnings from this particular incident are taken on board. And, you know, these boats are built to extremely high standards, and they're extremely well built. You know, they are genuinely designed, especially these 56-meter Perinis, to do everything and go anywhere. So they've got to be built extremely well. So all of that stuff, you've really got to kind of gently walk, you know, the mainstream press through, and make the point in the various radio interviews and TV interviews. It's tricky, but I can only hope I did a decent job of it, and just try and make the point that it's a good industry. It's a safe industry. You know, people are well trained, boats are well built. This is very uncommon. It's just an absolutely tragic event, and and everyone's devastated.
You talk about kind of all the different factors at play. I think that was a question I was getting asked time and time again, especially from people, you know, friends, family, people just watching the news, like, whose fault is this? That's the kind of key question that people come to you with. And it also showed me LinkedIn, what a scary place that's become. Like, that, you know, suddenly people I thought were serious, you know, serious business people are kind of writing these statuses about conspiracy theories. And you're suddenly aware that there's this platform which, you know, you'd previously thought was fairly professional and sane is spiraling into something. Yeah, it's just a platform for anyone who wants to have a voice to have one. And I don't think they were all saying well thought through things. You mentioned the keel, and you mentioned kind of misunderstandings to do with the boat. And I think it'd be useful for us to run through that in a second and just clear up some of the, you know, there are so many different reports of these things. Like I say, you probably know more than most people at this point about what the facts there are. But in terms of other people who did chip in, you know, reports have come out, statements have come out, some of them fairly criticized, rightly or wrongly. Whose voice do you think has been useful, or who have you listened to in this?
Well, a lot of the people I listened to in the kind of the first hours, really, upon learning about the incident. So I just reached out to very trusted project managers, captains that I knew, you know, who were absolute experts in this type of boat and in safety procedures and things like that. So I really leant on the network to help me understand better, because obviously I had a decent understanding, but not to the extent that some of these guys do. So I'm grateful to everyone who took the time to help me out last week. I really, really appreciate it. And not many people wanted to go on the record, which is absolutely fair enough in the kind of initial wave of press coverage following the incident. One person who has been absolutely bombarded by requests for comment is Stephen Edwards. So Stephen's the captain of the 60-meter Perini Seahawk, and he was formerly the captain of Bajan, and we'll get to his comments in just a bit. But your comment about LinkedIn was, I mean, yeah, it is a bit of a Wild West LinkedIn sometimes, and my tolerance for LinkedIn is pretty low, and I'm not a massive fan. But, you know, occasionally you do have to weigh in. And you also mentioned conspiracies. So how the story developed over the course of the week was by Saturday, Pete, you know, the journalists were kind of, in the absence of facts, they were sort of running out of stuff to write about. So there's a couple of, the Telegraph wrote a story about, you know, some of the conspiracies surrounding the sinking. And they had lifted a quote from a previous story in The Independent, which quoted me saying, hang on, I can bring it up exactly what they quoted me as saying. So the Indian and the Telegraph quoted me as saying, I've been speaking to a lot of the industry today and they're as shocked as me enough to disbelieve that this could happen. So I didn't know they'd run these stories. And then when the Telegraph ran that story featuring that quote from me, I got some WhatsApps from people saying, are you leaning into the conspiracy theory? Because taken in the wrong context, you know, that comment sounds like, you know, there's something dodgy going on. There's some kind of nefarious element to the whole story. Like, it could be a conspiracy. So I got really, really angry because I didn't say that. So they had taken some words and messed around with them, really. So I'd spoken earlier in the week to the BBC.
I'm feeling the rage here through the other side of the screen.
So what I actually said was, I've been speaking to a lot of the industry today, and they are similarly as shocked as me, and just in utter disbelief that this could happen. So just, you know, yeah, an initial kind of, you know, holy shit, holy fuck, we cannot, what is this, is impossible to understand or wrap your head around. Everyone's in a state of complete shock.
But there's such a world of difference, isn't it? Just a few words changing that changes absolutely everything. And it's suddenly a voice that backs a kind of a conspiracy theory about this all being deliberately engineered. And that's just, yeah, it's not the case.
No, yeah, not the case at all. And, you know, these stupid conspiracies that are flying around are just unbelievable.
Well, they ignore so much. The conspiracy theories, what I don't get is they just, it's not like, I don't know, other conspiracy theories where you think, oh, I can see how you could angle it that way. You know, there's clear evidence to show people are just kind of reading things in the way that you want to. And when you say, well, that's not what happened because there was a witness there or there was that, people are just like, well, you know, I still think there's something funny going on. You think, what's that all about?
It's just a symptom of 21st century existence. I think people are just desperate for there to be some kind of other explanation, instead of just a simple tragic incident. So I did use LinkedIn a little bit.
Yeah.
To make the point that I didn't say what they said.
I'm keeping off LinkedIn for me. It's not for me. I'm just going back to a pen and paper, just head in the sand. Can you actually talk through what the keel is on the boat, what the mast is on the boat, and whether all is correct there, and what the misunderstandings were around them, or the questions that kind of were thrown up, kind of as clearly as possible?
Yeah, well, to do that, why don't we refer to, so, Stephen Edwards, the captain of Seahawks. So he, like I mentioned, he was bombarded with requests, and he eventually got so fed up with, I think he just wrote this quite long statement addressing all these points. Mm. Which he's posted on LinkedIn as well. So I just thought it'd be interesting to pull out some of his comments from the statement. He said, "I have no desire to contribute to the wild speculation and claims that we have seen so far, or in any way suggest what really happened. Only those on board at the time will know that, but I can shed some light on the characteristics of the vessel and some of the limitations that would likely be involved in this disaster." So the mast, he said, you know, as we know, is one of the biggest aluminium masts in the world, major feature of the yacht, and presented structural challenges in construction and ongoing life. As it pushed the boundaries of aluminium mast construction, there were lessons that had to be learned over the years, but the result was a robust and well-controlled rig in the end that performed well within the limits of the design. And he'd know better than anyone, having captained the boat for some years.
And I had heard that the mast had been, you know, taken down a number of times. Is that necessarily that's not an indicator that there were issues there?
Well, masts are stepped occasionally for repair or upgrades or fiber optic upgrades, or, you know, you got to fix a spreader, or, you know, there's different reasons masts are stepped. And I think I'm right in saying that Bajan's mast was stepped last in 2016, but I would have to check that detail.
Yeah.
So then he went to talk on about the ballast of the boat. So referencing the mast, Stephen said, "The height of Bajan's mast was, of course, considered in the overall design of the boat by Preeny's engineers. To this end, she was equipped with an extra 30 tons of lead ballast in her keel box compared to her 56-meter ketched rigged sister ships. This was to counter the extra mass, higher center of gravity, and higher center of effort that the sloop rig created. So all of that ballast was contained in a more or less rectangular kind of keel box beneath the boat." He reckoned that he said he couldn't remember the precise mass of this ballast, but it's probably around 200 tons or so, he reckons. "Within the center part of this keel box, there is a movable keel which weighed around 60 tons and extended almost 6 meters below the keel box when lowered. This arrangement," he said, "means that the majority of the righting moment of the vessel comes from the main ballast, the movable keel acting more as a centerboard to reduce side slip when under sail."
Right.
And just further on the keel box, he went on when he was talking about stability. The centerboard in this particular vessel's case was required to be lowered when using sails and or when over 60 miles offshore, regardless of when sailing or only using the engines. At all other times, as in anchored in relatively shallow water, as in the case of Bayesian last week. It could be the keel, the centreboard rather, could be in the raised position.
So the keel wasn't required to be down, and they were doing nothing wrong by not having the keel down if they didn't, right?
No. According to the Bayesian stability book, there was no requirement for the keel to be down, and class wouldn't have required, yeah. So basically, on paper, yep, certainly,
yeah,
the keel didn't have to be down. Stephen goes on to talk about the angle of vanishing stability, which again is quite a hard concept to explain, obviously, to journalists with no concept of sailing, and the down flooding angle. So the angle of vanishing stability is the angle of heel at which the vessel righting moment reaches zero, meaning that the vessel will not return to upright. So the down flooding angle is the angle of heel at which water will start to enter the vessel, usually through the engine room or accommodation ventilation ducts. Once this starts, the vessel is in serious trouble as stability is quickly reduced or lost due to the flooding. So that he reckons, he wrote that the down flooding angle for Bayesian was around 40 to 45 degrees. And he mentioned, unless the vent dampers are closed, the vessel will start to flood rapidly if heeled more than the down flooding angle. So if heeled over for a sustained period at more than 40 to 45 degrees, that is a down flooding angle, and flooding of the boat will occur, which will ultimately cause it to sink. And I won't obviously read out everything he wrote. I'll put the link obviously in the description, and I encourage everyone with an interest in the story, which should be everyone frankly, to read Stephen's note, because it's a brilliant analysis of Bayesian's naval architecture, stability and rig, and from someone who really, really knows what he's talking about. But I will read the summary. Let me just read the summary. The vessel Bayesian was sound and seaworthy by design, and to my knowledge, well-maintained as such. However, heeling her to more than around 45 degrees while in normal operational state could result in flooding and subsequent loss if the flooding could not be controlled. The weather conditions that could have created these extreme circumstances can indeed occur with very little warning, and being so localized, they are difficult to prepare for, leaving a very short time for the crew to react. How the vessel came to be taken outside her operation limits is what the investigators will need to determine, which I am sure they will.
I'm particularly interested in the weather aspect of it, just because when everybody's been talking about lame and, you know, the build of the boat, the captain, the crew, all of that kind of thing, you know, in my experience, everybody that works in the industry is always incredibly professional, thorough, all the rest of it. So the weather is a kind of question mark for me over, did they see that coming? Did they not? Could they have? Is it that weather is changing more quickly than we could ever possibly anticipate, and these kind of freak incidents happening? This isn't the only freak weather incident we've heard of over the summer. There have been various other things going on. So I wanted to draw attention to the fact, you know, you mentioned seeking out experts and learning more where we don't know enough. Our deputy editor Caroline interviewed a kind of proper expert in the field, weather expert, this week, and we're going to be putting that out as a separate podcast, speaking about Bayesian, but also more general questions that owners would want to know, and those in the industry. So his name's Sebastian. He is a senior meteorologist at Wettervelt, which is an organization that produces highly individualized weather forecasts, using constantly updated tech. And they generate these really high precision forecasts and weather analysis. So that podcast is going to be coming out shortly, and I'd urge anyone listening to listen to that directly so you can hear exactly what he has to say and in the proper context. But to give just a bit of insight into, you know, a summary of what he said, he noted that though you can't predict the exact location and the type of severe weather, you should know when a cold front is coming, and that captains should know these things. And then you should know, you know, it should be possible to know within a few hours that you're going to have severe weather coming. And he said that was especially true in the Med, which has, as we all know, very high temperatures, meaning there's lots of possible energy in the atmosphere. So that was interesting to me. He also said in that recording that he wasn't surprised that a downdraft, this, you know, water spout, tornado, whatever we want to call it, type thing.
Downburst, no? I think that was the, downburst. That's the latest.
Yeah. I'm not keeping up with this, sorry. But he said that could sink. He wasn't surprised that one of those could sink a yacht. He said, particularly if it had two anchors, which I wasn't sure about, but that would mean then the boat wasn't able to move with the weather. So he wasn't surprised that something like that could cause a boat to sink and cause that damage. He also noticed that the surface area of a mast that tall was enough that strong winds hitting it could tilt a boat 90 degrees, was what he thought. Lastly, he had said that the weather conditions that came up were very clear. As far as he were concerned, there were no surprises from his point of view. But we'll put that out shortly. So keep an eye out for that and do have a listen to what he has to say.
Thanks, Charlotte. The weather's a massive part of the investigation. I imagine we're all going to learn a fair bit about a bit more about these highly localized extreme weather events in the Mediterranean. But from what I've, I'm no weather expert, but these particular extreme events, they seem to me, from the people I've spoken to be very hard to predict. The fact that Beijing was caught in an extremely unfortunate and very violent one is, it just seems like it's a terrible place at a terrible time.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll obviously be speaking more about this story as the weeks go on and as we learn more about what happened and when the facts from these various investigations are released, and we'll keep you posted. But in summary, horrible story and desperately sad for all those involved. And just to repeat again, our hearts and thoughts go out to those who lost people on the boat, and also with the survivors who must be going through a very rough time at the moment. So let's get on to some brokerage picks. Charlotte, you've been digging through the brokerage stories this week.
I have. I like to feel I always bring something different to the brokerage picks when I'm on the podcast. I feel like I go for the underdog or the outside choice. And so here we go. So I've got quite a rogue choice this week, and I've actually got no idea when she hit the market, to be honest. But certainly an unforgettable boat to look at, and I'm definitely going to say this wrong, Teestrup. You can probably guess where she comes from. She's a 49.55 meter explorer, originally built in 1985, not particularly recent, by, and this is another pronunciation challenge,
good luck with this,
N.V. Schwipsverben van Langebrugge for the Belgian government.
I think you did that brilliantly. It's exactly how I would have said it.
It's wrong, isn't it?
I would have said Brugge, Langebrugge. I think
Brugge, Langebrugge.
Yeah.
Okay. I should have practiced this. Anyway, try and remember that name. It was built by them for the Belgian government. And the potential here, I think you do have to cling on to the potential as I'm talking about it. The potential is massive. So the listing talks about the potential for enhancing her with a luxury finish. You can assume, and I think if you look through the pictures, you'll see she is not currently luxurious. But there's a method in my madness here, because it says how, her construction's been meticulously maintained throughout her service. She offers accommodation for 12 guests and 10 crew. And I feel like I've got a bit of insider intel here, because I've just been doing, I did a massive deep dive recently on We're Running, a feature. We've got a big refit issue coming out in November. And I was doing a lot of research around exactly this kind of vessel, these sort of refit conversion vessels. So vessels that were not built as super yachts that owners have bought, whether they were survey vessels or spy ships or whatever, and turn them into private yachts. And I think I'm a convert, having originally thought, oh my God, what are these weird looking things? Actually, there's a lot of big pluses to going down this route. It's a lot of personal time and energy, so it's not a low maintenance path to be taking. You don't necessarily save money, which is something that people kind of toss around, unless you're happy with a boat that doesn't feel like a traditional super yacht, doesn't sound like a traditional super yacht. But you can save time. You have a boat that's been tried and tested and proven, which, if you want to go to really, really out there destinations, is a great place to start. One of the people I interviewed for the piece commented, if you want a boat that's strong enough to go to Antarctica, why would you not start with a boat that's been to Antarctica? I think, yeah, they make a good point. If you're going to be putting a yacht through its paces, why not start with one that has already done that?
That's interesting you made the money comment, because I think part of the attraction of these kind of boats is you think, you can buy them super cheap and spend a third that you would on building a new one. So the economics of it add up. But actually, from the people you've been speaking to, that's not true at all.
Well, no, you do save money. I can't remember. I think, you know, the first person I quoted on it had said, oh yeah, you can save up to 60%, which I don't think is the case. Certainly not today. I think it used to be that you could buy these vessels for an absolute song because no one was doing it. Today, I don't think that's the case. I think the estimate was around, okay, 30, 40%, maybe you can. I think the key thing that came up again and again was, how much do you want your yacht to feel like a super yacht? If you want your yacht to feel just like a super yacht, then you'll have to spend a lot of money to get it there. Yeah. If you're happy with, you know, someone else I quoted said, oh, you know, I don't mind having the kind of noise on the back of my boat. And if I did, that was going to cost me 10 million euros to get rid of. So there are little kind of compromises at every turn. Do I mind if my boat feels a bit different? Do I mind if it has this kind of funky thing here that maybe other people don't notice, but someone really experienced would notice? So yeah, whether you save money on the cost, and the other main takeaway from it, and maybe we can do a separate pod on it at a different time, is the donor vessel that you're starting in. It sounds obvious, but that's so key, because if that's kind of an empty hull, so you're essentially building a new build inside it, then great, you get rid of a whole load of problems by doing that. Or if that's, you know, a kind of weird boat in an amazing condition that you're happy to work around, you can also save quite a lot of money that way, but there are restrictions on what you can do. And if you're starting with a boat that needs a lot doing to it, there was a quote from someone saying, it's like saying, what's the difference between a 20K Rolls Royce and a 30K Rolls Royce? And the answer is about 10K of restoration cost. You know, you have to know what you're going into. And I think a lot of time, these vessels that people look at initially just don't make financial sense. I think you have to hunt quite hard to find one that is going to give you that kind of Cinderella moment. But anyway, so this is my pick because it's a blank canvas. It looks kind of weird, but kind of cool. I quite like it.
It is literally a canvas, isn't it? It's an extraordinary artwork on its own.
I do not like that. If I was the one thing I said, I think it's a jellyfish.
No, I think it's a brain. It's a brain and a kind of a like blood vessels or a tree or something.
Really? I thought it was a jellyfish.
I'm sure there's a brain there.
Taste is a very personal thing. It's not for me, the paint work. But hey, if I bought it, I could change it. And I would, definitely.
What is Tastreep asking?
That's a very good question. I'm going to have to look at it again because I was so carried away with the potential. I didn't actually look at the cost.
4.9 million euros.
That is cheap. And you could make that into a great boat. I actually love the kind of the colour on it, the yellow and the... I would kind of lean into the kind of rugged construction-y vibes and make something really funky and colourful and cool. And I think it could be a really fun... They're so unique, these boats. That is what's good about them. You've got a yacht that no one else will have and is entirely made for you. And you could say that about a custom super yacht, but I don't know. I think it's a bit more unusual.
And they're anonymous, aren't they? I mean, this sitting in a bay full of big white boats isn't going to get noticed. And that, I think, is quite a lot of the appeal of them sometimes.
Yeah.
If you want all the luxuries and comforts of a big yacht, but you don't want everyone to know you've got a big yacht and say, look at that rich guy with his big yacht, then these kind of boats, they're just like kind of commercial boats, work boats, surveying.
But I think they can be quite deceptive as well. They look, it's like those French houses with the kind of crunchy shutters and then you go inside and they're absolutely beautiful. Yeah. Like I think sometimes they don't look like much from the outside or they look, you know, a bit strange and inside they're incredible. So I quite like that secret aspect.
Having said that, there's nothing secret about this paint job with its...
No. Look, I think you're really raining on my potential here. Like I think there's a lot you could do with this boat. Starting with the paint, but also inside, I think it could be good. What have you picked?
Well, actually, I was just going to ask. I'm not familiar with this boat to Tastreep at all. So, if anyone actually knows, you can explain what that extraordinary paint work is on the side of the boat. Please let us know. I'd love to know. And it's why it's there.
I think it's coral and a jellyfish.
No, it could be coral. Yeah, it could be.
It's not clear though. No. I don't think it's a brain. Well. Maybe someone who's worked on it can come forward and end the debate once and for all.
Educate us, please.
Yeah, exactly.
So I've gone for another old boat, actually, Koru. This is the classic 50-meter Fed ship from 1983, Koru, and not obviously Jeff Bezos's massive 126-meter Ocean Go sailing yacht, Koru. Although if, you know, Jeff ever puts that one on the market or on Amazon, it'll be my brokerage pick too. Anyway, the Fed ship Koru was born as Azteca, and she has been listed with Worth Avenue Yachts asking 9.95 million euros. So quite apart from her imperious John Bannenberg lines, I would love this boat because it was originally built for El Tigre, Emilio Azcaraga, an owner, Mexican billionaire who did a huge amount for the superyachting business by building so many cool boats. Amongst them, 75-meter Echo, which is now known as Zeus, the boat he famously died on, aged just 66.
That's sad.
It is sad, yeah, because he had a few more boats in him. I have no doubt about that. Huge, larger-than-life character. And if you haven't read the brilliant feature Daniel Pembrey wrote for us about Azcaraga, I urge you to do it. Read it. Check it out. It's on the website. It's a brilliant examination of this massive Mexican personality and his boats. So Coru was built with a sister ship, Paraiso. And the idea, Emilio Azcaraga's idea, was to keep one in the Med and one in the Caribbean. It has most recently undergone a two-year refit. So it's got a lovely new paint job. It's got an extended stern. So its LOA has increased as a result. It's got a revamped sun deck and new interiors. So the broker, the Worth broker, noted that she boasts advanced technical upgrades, including overhauled engines, new navigation systems, and Starlink connectivity, making her a standout choice for discerning buyers seeking both historical significance and contemporary sophistication. Nice way to put it, isn't it? She is very significant historically. She's one of the landmark superyachts.
I have to say, she's a great boat. I'm annoyed that I didn't find this and pick it first because, yeah, I love the look of her, actually. I love, like you said, the lines, the kind of cleanness to it. She's a very elegant boat, but also kind of, I don't know, there's a kind of classic feel to it. I don't know. Yeah, lovely boat and a lovely history, like you say. That's a great
pick. I'm surprised no one in previous podcasts has chosen her because it seems an obvious one to me. But
yeah. But she's not a blank canvas. She's not She's not to Streep.
No. But you're only spending 5 million more euros and you get the complete boat without any hassle of refitting it.
Well, so, that's true. Yeah, it's a top pick. Can't argue with that.
Anyway, to Streep or Coru. We'll see which one goes first. I reckon Coru. Anyway, yeah. Let's whip through some headlines. Charlotte, why don't you take the first one?
Okay, so the first news story for this week is that the removal process for the 37.8-metre yacht Lovebug is well underway, with authorities having successfully refloated the vessel. The yacht took on water and ran aground in a tributary of Chesapeake Bay last month and has remained there since. Salvage works were slated to begin on 13th of August, but suffered some delays as a result of Tropical Storm Debbie, which brought strong winds and tides to the area. According to local reports, Lovebug is going to be towed to New Jersey and then it will be transported to a shipyard along the Morris River.
Next up, we have the news that 68-meter Abeking and Rasmussen superyacht Aviva has completed a major refit on Palumbo Superyachts facilities in Marseille, France. This marks one of the most significant projects undertaken by the yard in the past 8 years. Aviva was commissioned famously by British businessman and Tottenham Hotspur owner Joe Lewis and delivered as the flagship of the German shipyard in 2007. She was sold to another experienced owner in July 2023, with her asking price withheld. According to Palumbo, the most challenging alteration was the exterior, which received a fresh paint job to restore Aviva's original beauty and increase her value over time. Other works included a complete teak restoration on the exterior decks, refurbished accommodation, and an upgrade. Graded galley.
Sounds like quite the restoration going on there. Excited to see some pictures of that. Lastly, our final news story for the week is the news that the Finnish shipyard Nauta Swan has launched the 23.2-metre Sole 1 at San Lorenzo's shipyard in La Spezia, Italy. This follows the acquisition of Nauta Swan by San Lorenzo, which was announced this August. The yacht will make her worldwide debut at this year's Cannes Yachting Festival. Hopefully I can check her out because I'll be there. Sole 1 is the flagship of Nauta Swan's power yacht division, known as Swan Arrow. The model was revealed during last year's Cannes Yachting Festival and was initially conceived as a chase boat, but evolved over the design process until it became an independent day boat. The Finnish designer Jarkko Jamson is responsible for the yacht's exterior design, and he said he was inspired by the strong connection to the ocean that he saw on sailing yachts. "This is what I think draws people to sailing initially," he said. "We set out to maximize the sensation and enjoyment of being on the water and being outdoors, and then we combine that with all the comforts of a motor yacht." Well, a very exciting project to take a look at. I love Jarkko Jamson's boats. They're always a big hit with me.
Yeah, he's the man, Jarkko. Yeah. Looks like a woodsman.
Yeah, love him. Cool boats, cool guy.
Very impressive beard. I'm incapable of growing similar facial hair, so I look on his facial hair with awe.
Me too.
And now moving on to the data section, which, as ever, is brought to you by our brilliant market intelligence platform, Boat Pro. This week, we're going to be looking at the brokerage market in the first half of the year and how it measured up against previous years. The results found that a total of 211 brokerage transactions were completed in the first half of this year, down from 232 at the same point in 2023, 304 in 2022, and 382 in 2021. So fewer sales than previous years, but this year was slightly above the number of sales in 2019. And given how the rate of decline now appears to be slowing, brokers are holding out hope that this year will finish ahead of 2023 in terms of both the number of sales and gross value. So you're going to need a very positive H2 to achieve that. But interesting that the numbers ahead of 2019, because I remember people saying 2019 was a really strong year for brokerage.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they have. You mentioned kind of brokers were sort of fairly buoyant about this. I thought it was interesting. So Fraser's CEO came out saying, "The market has slowed down since then, but it's still registering more sales, higher values, and a higher average LOA than we saw before the pandemic." So I thought it was quite a kind of positive statement from him.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, considering what the market has gone through this year, and a lot of headwinds in the shape of high interest rates, inflation. Obviously, you know, the terrible conflict in Gaza, war in Ukraine, piracy concerns in the southern Red Sea. None of those things are great news for super yacht activity. It doesn't take a lot for an owner to delay a decision to not buy a boat because, you know, as some of the well-known figures in our industry point out quite often, you know, no one needs a super yacht. So it is a very much luxury lifestyle purchase. And so when the economy isn't so buoyant, it's a little harder to pull the trigger on these massive transactions. But overall, I think, I mean, the fact that it's done so well against, the, you know, given those headwinds is pretty impressive. So Gabby, our business editor, wrote that overall the results for H1 2024 suggest the industry is nearing the end of the renormalization period that followed its highest performing years on record, 2021 and 2022. And as we've pointed out in the podcast previously, it's a fool's errand comparing this year to 2021 and 2022 because they were just so out of the box anomalous that, you know, the like will never be seen again.
It's quite weird when you're comparing the stats because you think, well, you know, the past couple of years were freak years and then the pandemic years were freak years before that. And then, you know, at what point do you start comparing data and saying, okay, this is a comparable year? I think actually that never really happens in our industry because it's growing and changing and developing so quickly. You can compare this year's stats to 2008 stats, but it doesn't really, you know, make so much sense really.
No, the closest comparable year is 2019. But you draw just, you know, you just take a long-term trend. You look at 15 years worth of data and you draw a line. And, you know, things are, you know, even with the massive spikes in 2021 and 2022, it's still, the market's still showing consistent, reliable growth. So we've got a few predictions for you here. I'll do Raphael's and you do Richard Lambert's. So Raphael, the CEO of IYC, when looking ahead to the rest of the year, he said he expects to see more activity coupled with more price adjustments ahead of the upcoming boat show season. Owners, brokers, and shipyards are likely to be more flexible with negotiations due to low current demand, with buyers eager to secure good deals, he explained. Going on to say, demand for yachts in the 40 to 50 meter size range will remain a focal point in the market, while sales in the 50 meter plus segments are expected to stay stable in both the new and used brokerage market.
Okay. Well, Burgess's Richard Lambert said, "We were very surprised by the level of demand from our clients to have their yachts participate in the fall yacht shows," he said. "It is always a little difficult to look into the crystal ball of yacht brokerage. However, we are confident that the market will perform well in the second half of the year." I think that sounds like a fair prediction to me.
Yeah, well, two gents with an awful lot of experience in the market. So words not to be taken lightly from both of them, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
And that, I think, will wrap up this week's Boat Briefing podcast. Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Thank you, Stu.
Great to see you.
Yeah.
Editorial drink. We're drinking tomorrow night, aren't we?
We are. Editorial drinks are kind of annual event before everyone heads off to yacht shows all over the world, really. So editorial drinks, Cannes, Monaco. We'll be doing a Cannes preview coming up soon.
Yeah, lots of content to come. Lots of live content too from various shows. Journal. I mean, it's all happening now, doesn't it? You just kind of slightly gird yourself for this kind of slightly mad period. And the October issue is an absolute beast. So much good stuff in it. I was writing about it today, and it's just amazing. And massive kudos to you.
Thank you. I feel it's getting to the stage where I know it doesn't drop through people's doorsteps, but if it did drop through someone's doorstep, I feel like it can now do like serious harm. The October issue is quite heavy. It's quite a big mag. Yeah, exactly.
If your cat's on the doormat, the cat's in trouble.
Yeah, but we always love putting it together, you know? Everyone gets excited. Well,
the production team don't like putting it together. It's actually a nightmare.
We do love putting it together.
Oh, yeah, of course we do. We love it.
Anyway, we hope you love reading it.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Anyway, I'll see you tomorrow. And thanks, everyone, for listening to this week's episode of Boat Briefing, which is mixed and produced by the wonderful team of Adam Geist and Naomi Wilson and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we will see you next time.